I'm Kevin Kelly. This is Live and Local, your connection to local music and more. My guest today is Jeffrey McGee. He is a musicology professor, actually head of the department at the University of Illinois School of Music. And he is kind of a specialist in American music, by which we mean specifically the United States. Jazz, music theater, popular song, author of a number of books, working on one on Irving Berlin. And he will be hosting at the upcoming Allerton Barn Music Festival, the pre-concert show specifically about Irving Berlin. Jeff's my guest today. We'll be hearing a number of recordings that he's brought along, kind of representing the idea of the songbook. I think it'll be an entertaining hour. I'm very glad he's with us today. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. Arrangement by the Chestnut Brass Company, who also performed Cole Porter's In the Still of the Night here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. And my thanks to Jeff McGee, who is a musicology professor at the University of Illinois, for joining me on the show today. Teaches and writes about music in the United States. And we'll certainly be covering Irving Berlin, because that's immediate interest to him, since he's working on a book on Irving Berlin, and we'll be giving a talk on some of his songs for stage and screen at the upcoming Allerton Music Barn Festival. Thanks for coming in.
Sure, glad to be here.
So what got you interested in these in music of the United States specifically? How did you, that's a wide area in the first place, but it's in the area of quote-unquote classical music, which right. You usually think of schools of music, right. Is fairly specific.
I was a serious pianist when I was in high school and into college, and studying the sort of standard piano repertoire. Beethoven was kind of, I was really into Beethoven.
And, he's a good composer.
It feels good in the fingers, you know, when you can get on top of it. And then I went to graduate school for musicology, and in the 80s, and still somewhat today, historical musicology has been very Europe-centered, and for good reason. There's a great tradition of European music, and I loved it. I also took a course in American music and had a friend who was a composer and a jazz aficionado. And when these two things came together in my life in graduate school, I suddenly realized, you know, I'm getting a credential in, you know, knowing about music, and I don't know much about my own country. And it felt not just like something I wanted to add to my education, but a huge missing chunk of my education. And so that was kind of the way in. And I discovered when I went to Michigan in the middle of my grad school career that the local radio station had a huge collection of old 78s and some LP reissues. This is the mid to late 80s, just before CDs of all that stuff came out. And I had a project where I was just working in the radio station, dubbing cassettes, very 20th century technology, dubbing cassettes of these old, often 78 RPM records of jazz in the 20s and 30s. And it just, because jazz at that point was so saturated in popular song and blues, it was my interest gradually shifted from jazz, which was the focus of my first book on Fletcher Henderson, the arranger, to what I'm here to talk about, I guess, is the American song, the so-called Great American Songbook, because so much of these songs were the basis for the jazz tradition. And as it turns out, of course, really form a kind of, I think, core repertoire for any kind of musician, whether you're operatically trained, you're a jazz musician, you're a folk musician, country musicians, everybody has dipped into this common pool of song and found something new to do with it.
We'll certainly explore that a lot on the show today. I want to continue a little bit with your own background and interest. Did you end up doing a doctorate then in closer to this area?
Yeah, my PhD was the basis for my book on Fletcher Henderson. I talked about the music his band recorded in the 1920s in particular, which was a crucial decade for the emergence of jazz as a kind of national phenomenon. Henderson became a nice focal point for bringing in a lot of threads, not just in music history, but in American history, because he's kind of on the ground floor of early radio. He starts making records in the very year that race records, as they were called then, records by and for African American musicians, started really becoming a much broader phenomenon. And jazz is taking off. And he brings a actually, like me, he brought a classical background to jazz. Fletcher Henderson. And as I worked on this project, I realized I was kind of seeing a reflection of myself, which is always, you know, I think a lot of our scholarship is in the end autobiographical in some way, if you can only recognize it. And
have you expanded your own performing into the areas you're working in academically?
I play piano, and I'm able to use it in class, but I don't perform publicly. But certainly, I love playing, you know, these songs. I sit at home and do this all the time, and I take it into class, but that's as far as the performance goes. Yeah.
Have you gotten into jazz performing at all? Or playing?
Very little by myself. I don't play for anyone.
Least of all, surrounded by a faculty like the U of I's.
Exactly. Yeah, the jazz. The jazz studies faculty. I have good friends there, and we're constantly, you know, engaged with each other because we sit on doctoral committees together and so on. And I wouldn't touch an instrument in their presence, however.
And they do lots of performing here and elsewhere. Yeah. Which makes it a really exciting place.
And
to be.
I might add, by the way, that songbook evening at Allerton, if I may, that Monday night Labor Day, I'm doing the pre-concert on Berlin with some performers, so it's kind of a lecture performance. And then there's a break, and then the jazz faculty will be, with some guests, will be playing songbook jazz, basically jazz interpretation of the songbook. So.
Yeah, that's the Allerton Barn Music Festival, which we'll be covering a fair amount of the next couple of weeks. Running September 3rd through the 7th, Allerton Park in Monticello, and that's the final concert of the festival, calling it the Great American Songbook, Monday, September 7th, Labor Day, 8:30. Works by Gershwin, Carmichael, Rodgers and Hart, Kern, Mercer, Porter, and the pre-concert show. Does that begin earlier?
I'm told 6:30.
Actually, I just need to turn to the next page, and you were told correctly, according to their website. So you'll show up at the right time, 6:30. So when somebody says the Great American Songbook, you know, people could easily picture you can go out and buy it.
I was going to say, I knew that you were going to ask this. Yeah. And when someone first used that question, that phrase around me, I thought, yeah, where can I go get it? Because I want that thing. But of course, there is no such entity. It's a massive song repertoire of thousands of songs, usually associated with the period from maybe the late 19-teens, early 20s to the early 50s, when the likes of Gershwin and Porter and Rodgers and Hart and Irving Berlin and Jerome Kern and Harold Arlen were thriving. And those songwriters sort of form maybe the core of the core of this repertoire, but of course Hoagie Carmichael and many, many, many others. And then rock sort of became took the country by storm in the 50s, and the pop music scene changed a lot. But this songbook has never died. It's classic in every sense.
So it was once pop music, essentially.
Yeah,
and now
pop
it's
music has
music.
Become classic. That's right.
Yeah. Well, let's hear our first sample.
Well, I can't wait because this is one of my favorites. I almost didn't bring it because I thought it might be too obvious, but you can't get enough of this. This is Ella Fitzgerald doing Blue Skies in the 50s. She did this whole series of songbook albums, focusing on individual song writers, Berlin, all the ones I just named. This is off the Berlin. She did two Berlin albums, actually. And it's just got everything. She sings the tune, you know, and then she goes off on this virtuosic scat improvisation over the chords and comes back and sings the tune at the end. I don't know if we'll get that far into it, but it's just an unbelievable performance. And when I'm teaching about scat in jazz units of courses, I make sure, you know, some people say that scat is nonsense syllables. Well, nonsense is easy, but what Ella does and what Louis Armstrong do and other singers do with scat is very hard. And you'll hear this huge vocabulary of syllables and sounds and vocables out of her. The other fun thing, two other things before we start. Listen to her. She's a great quoter, as any Ella fan will know. You'll hear in the introduction, she does a little phrase from Hoagie Carmichael's Stardust. And in the middle of it, you hear a little bit of Mendelssohn's Wedding March, dum, bum, ba, bum, bum, ba, ba, da, and then Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. So something else to listen for. One other thing is the great arrangement. Ella's famous, but the arrangers are not as well known. And just a kind of a shout out to her arranger, Paul Weston here, who really does a wonderful job creating a musical framework and support for her singing.
And who's she performing with in this recording?
This is Paul Weston leading his orchestra, basically.
Okay, Ella Fitzgerald in Blue Skies of Irving Berlin here on Live and Local. We're with Jeff McGee on FM 90.9. Blue skies smiling at me, nothing shining so bright, never saw things going oh so right, noticing the days hurrying by, when you're in love. Great Ella Fitzgerald, Blue Skies by Irving Berlin, and her own take on it. with the considerable participation of the arranger, whose name I now can't find and have forgotten. So Jeff
Weston.
McGee will tell us.
Weston.
Paul Weston. Yeah. I know a Paul Weston. I assume it's not the same guy. And you're listening to Live and Local here on FM 90.9. Our programs today are made possible with support from Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign, also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information is available at 352-9713. Jeffrey McGee is with us here on Live and Local to talk a bit about this thing called the Great American Songbook. You know, we talked that there, you know, you can't just go buy a book. But I'll bet you there are books by now that you can go buy that have, you know, that are probably called that in some subset or something like that.
Yeah, I tend to shy away from those. I like to go for the ones with that feature a composer's collection, or, you know, you can get like a Sinatra songbook, and it has a lot of the ones he sang a lot. And then, of course, jazz musicians have massive fake books with at least the chords and melodies of these tunes.
And the recorded songbooks, as you mentioned, this one from which we heard Ella Fitzgerald called the Irving Berlin Songbook.
That's right.
and then lots of what a great collection of just you have those recordings.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Of Ella Fitzgerald.
I use those in teaching and just my own listening all the time. They're great.
What did one have to do to get your song considered for this songbook? I mean, again, it's not something that somebody puts into a collection, but you know, what do you think makes a classic?
I don't think a composer has control over it. It's if it has legs with performers and audiences. And Berlin was always one. Whenever anyone asked him, "What are your favorite songs?" he trotted out the old familiar tunes: Blue Skies, Alexander's Ragtime Band, Always, There's No Business Like Show Business, Oh How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning, God Bless America, White Christmas. He trotted out the familiar ones because those are the ones that people wanted to hear over and over again. So his standard was actually not whether he thought it was great. It was, did other people think it was great? Do other people want to sing it? Has it lasted? So it's the songbook is a collectively made thing, and I should say it keeps on changing. And if we have time toward the end, I want to talk about how rock era songs are now and have been for years now been incorporated as jazz and cabaret songs.
Sure. Have you made any attempt to figure out whether songs that have become these classics that people want to hear and all have always wanted to hear, if they have anything in common or a list of things in common?
Yeah, I wish there was a formula. Berlin himself started writing. He had an idea for a book, and I found the outline of it in the Library of Congress among his papers, and it was called The Secret of Songwriting. And he had outlined the whole thing, and you just look at something like that and you think, Berlin, The Secret of Songwriting. This must be it.
I can do it.
He had lots of suggestions, but I think it's telling that he never published it because in the end, you can do everything that Irving Berlin says, but you will not be Irving Berlin. And your song, you know, may or may not have what it takes, even if you follow all of somebody's rules.
And even if you are Irving Berlin, doesn't mean your song's going to make it either.
Yeah, he was writing songs every day, and he was lucky if 1 out of 10 of them got anywhere, and a lot of them didn't get published either.
And then probably 1 out of 10 of those maybe got somewhere initially, but didn't, as you said earlier, have legs.
Exactly.
And I would think jazz guys, it would be a good question to ask some jazz performers, mm-hmm. because... And I imagine it would have a lot to do with whatever the chord structure is.
Right. Well, this is the thing about the songs that have lasted is that they're like the old Rorschach test. Musicians and listeners will see or hear in them different things depending on what their musical inclination is. So jazz musicians look at chords. They look at melody to some extent, but the instrumentalists are not usually thinking about the words. They may know the words and be interested in the words, but generally, that's not what it's about. Singers, of course, often go words first and look for a nice tune, too, and maybe don't think as much about the harmony.
And of course,
and if you put it all together in a song like Blue Skies, then that's to me a great way to start this discussion, because you have, here's a song, came out in 1927. It was inserted in a Broadway show by Richard Rodgers and Lawrence Hart, which really made them mad because it was the big hit of the show. Then it got into a movie starring Al Jolson, one of the first talking pictures. He sang it in The Jazz Singer. Then it became a swing era standard. You know, Ella Fitzgerald picked it up. Other jazz musicians like Thelonious Monk wrote a tune partially based on Blue Skies. Pete Seeger did it. Willie Nelson did Blue Skies. They all hear something different in it, and they bring something new to it every time they perform.
You know, I'm actually glad you mentioned Willie Nelson. And maybe it's on this one disc. I think was it called Stardust that he did?
Yeah, I think so.
Years
right.
ago.
It's all standards.
Yeah. And I really like that. I don't know where I got it one time. And I went to the vintage vinyl sale that WYLL sponsors every year, and that's one of those that had umpteen copies of it that people were trying to get rid of. And I'm thinking, he really has quite a way with those songs. Mm-hmm. Stardust was one of them. I guess that was the name of it. Anyway, we have next Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, let's do this one. This is Frank Sinatra doing one of his sort of personal repertoire standards, I Get a Kick Out of You. Of course, a lot of other musicians have done it as well. Cole Porter song. This is Sinatra, the sort of 50s and 60s Sinatra, the swagger, the swinger, playing here with a big band, and it's arranged by a great big band arranger named Neil Hefti, who worked with Basie and Woody Herman. It's a really powerful swaggering tune, but I want to play this and then remark on it afterwards, because we have, what's interesting about the songbook too is that you can have a singer like Ella Fitzgerald who does her own, you know, obviously melodic reinterpretation of it, but she's basically capturing the sentiment of joy and optimism expressed in that song. Here, I want to listen to it and then talk about how this, you could hear this as kind of going against the affect or the emotion of the song. But this is, you know, people that know I Get a Kick Out of You often think of this performance as iconic. So let's listen to it.
Really? Frank Sinatra with Neil Hefti and his band on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol, it doesn't move me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you? Some like the vibe with some gal in the sky is my idea of nothing to do. Yet I get a kick, yes, I get a kick, yes, I get a kick out of you.
Frank Sinatra, I Get a Kick Out of You of Cole Porter with the band conducted by Neil Hefti, his arrangement as well for big band here on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
I just wanted to add for that one, I raised this idea of how a performance can kind of, in a way, cut against the grain of a song's affect as it's written. Now, to me, a key line in this is not the title line, I Get a Kick Out of You, which says, okay, I love you, you know. It's the line, though it's clear to me you obviously don't adore me. Now that's a line that in the songwriting trade belongs in a torch song, which is a sad song of someone who is suffering from unrequited love, right? And when you hear Ella Fitzgerald and many other singers do this, they bring that tinge of melancholy out, poignancy, that this is unrequited love. But Frank brings out the title line. It's all about the kick, and the hefty arrangement literally gives you these brass kicks to reinforce that. And he's obviously not suffering in love. The protagonist or the persona that Sinatra is projecting here is not suffering in love. He's swaggering, he's confident, and if someone doesn't love him, he'll go on to the next.
Well, that was also Sinatra to a degree.
Yes,
too.
Right.
But isn't that in the song itself too? I mean, even if I mentioned while we were listening to this that Louis Armstrong, I was actually listening to a disc that had him doing this while I was on vacation. And the song itself treats it that way to a degree also.
I think you can do it either way. It depends on what, and that's the beauty of the song. I think it's written in such a way that you can bring out that kind of confidence and optimism. Or you can say, now there's a key line. I get a kick out of you, but you don't love me.
Yeah, which is, that's the conflict of the
song. So you can sing it as if you're enjoying the kick, which is fun, or you can sing it as if the other person doesn't care. And that's got an element of sadness in it.
Hopefully we'll have time a little later to do, I know you brought along some pairs of performances.
Yeah,
of
if we have time, comparison, contrast.
That would have been a fun one to do. We'll have to have you back. So there's already a reason to have you back.
It was hard to decide what to bring, so anytime. Yeah.
And we you know, we won't get to anywhere near what you did bring. Did I read this? I didn't, so I think I'd better. Programs in WYLL are made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, whose 26th season explores literary and musical themes from opera to Broadway, featuring works from Beethoven to Cole Porter, and opens with a musical homage to William Shakespeare. More information is available at 333-6280. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9, and our connection today is with Jeffrey McGee, who is on the musicology faculty at the University of Illinois, specializing in music of the United States, jazz, musical theater, popular song, and particularly today, kind of focusing on this thing called the Great American Songbook, leading up in part to a pre-concert event he's hosting at the upcoming Allerton Music Barn Festival. The festival runs at Allerton Park in Monticello from the 3rd through the 7th of September. This is the culminating concert called the Great American Songbook, with U of I jazz faculty, guest vocalists, and performers. And the pre-concert lecture, Jeff McGee with a number of singers as well, and he's calling it Now It Can Be Told, Irving Berlin's Songs for Stage and Screen. That's going to be at 6:30 on the 7th of September. So you're writing this book on Irving Berlin now. Where do you start? And are you focusing on, what are you focusing on particular?
Okay, the only way I could start was not realizing that I was writing a book, because it would have been too intimidating. The first thing that strikes you about Berlin is the just sheer enormity of his life and career. He was born in Russia. His first memory was of watching his house burn down during a pogrom in the Ukraine, I believe it was. He comes with the great immigrant wave to New York in the 1890s. He lives for a total of 101 years. He died in 1989. He published songs over more than half a century of that career, starting in 1907, going into the 60s. He was there at every key moment of popular song and theater and film history. early Tin Pan Alley, when the popular song industry is getting kind of sort of focused and centered in New York City. He's there when early American musical comedy is really getting off the ground and getting its own identity in the teens. He's known as a ragtime composer, kind of a countercultural figure in the teens. In his embrace of ragtime, which many people thought was, like hip-hop in the 80s, it wasn't seen as music. And then, of course, it becomes mainstream pop. He was considered a jazz composer in the 20s. He's there in Hollywood. We talked about how Al Jolson sang Blue Skies in The Jazz Singer, one of the first talkies. He writes songs for Astaire and Rogers for their great classic musicals. And on and on. So it's a huge career. My book is about Berlin's career in the theater. And he was he's best known as a songwriter for his individual songs, but he was a real man of the theater. He loved the theater. He loved telling stories through song and staging. I had already gotten into Berlin through Blue Skies, actually, because I wrote an extended essay on that song. And then someone saw that, invited me to do this book as part of a theater, musical theater series. So that's, it kind of, in the way, the instigation came from the outside. But I had already been into this. And by then I thought I was caught, I was hooked.
So the song, as is appropriate, was the impetus for for your interest.
Yeah.
We have one next by Yip Harburg.
Yeah, this is Yip Harburg with one of his collaborators, Burton Lane. Yip Harburg, of course, best known for his work with Harold Arlen on the songs for Wizard of Oz, Over the Rainbow. He also wrote great songs for Finian's Rainbow. Rainbow guy wrote several Rainbow songs. Old Devil Moon, How Are Things in Glacamora. This is a song that's not as well known, but I think it's hilarious. It's called Poor You, and it gets at this, as we'll hear the singer singing it at a recording of a concert devoted to Yip Harburg's lyrics that was actually sent to me by Yip Harburg's son, and it's not commercially available, but I love this song. It's hilarious, and it's a great illustration of the old challenge that all these songwriters faced, which was boiled down to the phrase, how do you say I love you in 32 bars?
And
let's hear how Yip Harburg does that in this great one.
There's a little spoken introduction by
the singer is Philip Officer, whose work I don't know otherwise, but he does a nice job with this. And he's you can hear the live audience there, and he's explaining briefly for 10 seconds or so why he wants to sing the song.
Poor You by Yip Harburg, yes. On Live and Local.
I think the most difficult task that any songwriter, most particularly a lyricist, faces is trying to find a new take on a love song. Yip did it. I'm sad for anybody who's walking about, who's missed all the thrills I've been through. I'm sad for anybody who hasn't found out just what your caresses can do. And that's why I'm especially sad for you. Poor you. I'm sorry you're not me, for you will never know what loving you can be. Poor you. You never feel your charms. You never feel your warmth. You're never in your arms. When it is you I'm kissing, I pity you constantly. You don't know what you're missing, for you're only kissing poor me. Poor you. You live your whole life through, and yet you'll never know. love loving you.
That is an interesting take on how do you say I love you.
It's one of the most self-effacing pop songs I've ever heard, because you know so many of these are, you know, here's how I'm feeling, and the assumption is my feelings are very important and you should share them. Here, the songwriter says, I'm nothing much and I'm sorry for you because you're kissing me.
But also, I'm sorry for you because you're not experiencing what I'm experiencing.
That's
the great compliment, you know,
right,
to the other person.
Exactly.
What was Yip Harburg's first name? I can't remember. I've just stumped you.
E-Y. Ernest? I think it's Ernie.
I don't remember. I'm going to have to look it up now when we play the next
song.
Yeah. Because we only ever hear Yip.
You got me. That's right. Yeah.
Which nobody does names like they used to do back then either, nicknames. Yeah. And that the singer there, as we said earlier, we neither of us really knew about. Maybe you do, Philip Officer, and from a commercially non-available recording. So if you want that, too bad. That is the exclusive property of our guest.
As far as I know, anyway. Yeah.
Jeff McGee's our guest on Live and Local, and he teaches music of the United States at the University of Illinois School of Music. How long have you been at the university?
Only four. I'm starting my fourth year.
Yeah. And it seems to me that it's been quite a while since I've been out of this school. I came down here in 91 to do conducting and didn't take many musicology classes. And so I knew some of the faculty then. But it seems to me like the faculty has expanded a good deal, and particularly the offerings have expanded a good deal to include things on the more popular side.
Oh, sure.
You know, the non-classical
stuff. The Jazz Studies program, for one, has grown from virtually nothing a decade ago to a real powerhouse now. And then a number of my colleagues are also interested in popular music from various angles. My colleague in musicology, Gabriel Solis, does a lot with rock. My wife Gail, is why I'm here, because they hired her and I followed along, and she does a lot of work on film music right now, and writing a book on music in Robert Altman's films. And Altman, it turns out, was a huge fan of the musical, and when you watch his films, they're just laced with music constantly. Some of them aren't as successful as others, but music and the conception of a film as a kind of musical is a foundation for everything he does.
Well, let's talk about musical theater a little bit, mm-hmm. since partly because that's the focus you're taking with Irving Berlin, and also in part because on Friday on this show we're going to have what I think will be a very special program. Some listeners will have known a woman named Kathy Murphy, who was involved with the Champaign-Urbana Theater Company and other theater in the area. And there's a show at Centennial High School in Champaign on Saturday paying tribute to her, and we're going to do the same on this show on Friday. So we'll be hearing a lot of great songs from musical theater that I think were favorites of hers. But how many, if there is such a thing as a percentage, it seems like it was an awful lot of the songs that, you know, make it into this songbook, as it's called, came out of musical theater. I mean, they written with some dramatic purpose in mind,
sure.
But then again, some of them were written first, and then they get thrown into musicals.
Right. I would say, I don't know the percentages, but a majority are probably for theater or film, you know, from some kind of dramatic or comedic context, which is often lost. Gershwin's The Man I Love is a great example. It could never find a home in a show. It was written for, I can't even keep it straight, but it was written for something in the early 20s. In 1924, got pulled from that, got reinserted into another show later, pulled from that. It was kind of an orphan, but it's lasted. And Blue Skies is a rarity in that it wasn't conceived for a show, but that's how it got launched. It was in, like I said, a Rodgers and Hart show. It was inserted into a failing production. So and I get a kick out of you. Porter wrote for a show, Ethel Merman, great stage performer, premiered it. So the theater is a rich kind of soil for these songs.
In the case of Irving Berlin, how many of these songs for the theater were written specifically for the theater as opposed to written and then plugged into shows? I've always been curious when that happened.
He got his start writing songs that got inserted, or as they call it, say, interpolated into shows in the teens and 20s. Then he started taking more charge of his own shows, and hundreds of songs that many of us just know from, you might just know as songs separate from any show, actually had their roots and were intended for a show.
Now, that doesn't happen much anymore where the shows are really wholly conceived, but what would happen? Say, here's a show that somebody did, and then somebody decides to throw in this Cole Porter song that doesn't necessarily fit the drama,
yeah,
but yet they somehow work it in.
Yeah, it was a whole... People tend to mark Oklahoma, 1943, as the advent of a new kind of musical where there was created whole cloth. The term, the catchword, is integration, where song, dance, dialogue, character development, plot development are all tightly woven together. In the 20s and 30s and before that, shows were very performer-driven. So songs were inserted because people liked to hear so-and-so, Al Jolson, for example, singing his famous tunes. So plot didn't matter. Plot and character mattered less than seeing a star performer.
So the show was just a vehicle for these guys to sing songs, and in some cases songs that people already knew.
Exactly.
Or really liked.
Yeah.
And, of course, we talked earlier about jazz musicians picking up songs and having their own reasons for turning something into a classic. And there's no words to this next performance of a Rodgers and Hart tune.
We're going to do... Yeah, I want to listen to this. This is Miles Davis in a quartet with Horace Silver, Art Blakey, and Percy Heath, piano, drums, bass, playing a Rodgers and Hart tune called It Never Entered My Mind, from an otherwise obscure musical in the, I think it was late 30s, early 40s. But Miles Davis in the 50s, he's always playing, he always played pop songs. He cut his teeth in bebop, and a lot of bebop was based on harmonic progressions of popular song. I Got Rhythm, most famously, perhaps. In the 50s, he's playing more pop in a series of albums, from the early and mid 50s. And this is, I think, a good, very simple example of what he could do with a pop song. It's just, it's that famous Miles Davis muted, walking on eggshells, tenderness and vulnerability. The song is about someone who, the title refers to someone who basically, it didn't occur to me that we would never be together. We wouldn't be together forever. And so it's kind of a torch song. And in Rodgers' writing of it, he kind of just bounces along and alternates between two chords for a long part of it. But Miles Davis takes this tune, as he always did, and puts his own stamp on it here and adds a very rich, not terribly complicated chord substitution to it. And it really brings out the song's poignancy. And he playing it with a mute, pretty much sticking close to the melody. He does a beautiful job of evoking what this song's about without ever anyone singing a word.
It Never Entered My Mind, Rodgers and Hart, played by Miles Davis and his colleagues here on Live and Local on FM 90.9.
Thank you.
Miles Davis playing music by Rodgers and Hart. It never entered my mind. And here on Live and Local on FM 90.9, he's joined by pianist Horace Silver, bassist Percy Heath, drummer Art Blakey. And this is Live and Local. We're talking today with Jeffrey McGee of the University of Illinois School of Music about the Great American Songbook. First, before we continue, and we'll have an interesting comparative sample to close out the show in just a moment, this is a test of the emergency alert system. That was a test of the emergency alert system. And let me give one more pitch before we introduce this last song and say farewell to our guest for this outing. The Allerton Barn Music Festival, which is coming up September 3rd through the 7th at Allerton Park in Monticello, will have as its closing concert one called The Great American Songbook on Monday, September 7th at 8:30, performed by U of I jazz faculty and guest vocalists. And the pre-concert lecture will be given by our guest today, Jeffrey McGee. That's at 6:30 on September the 7th. He's joined by some singers, Don Harris, Ashley Klingler, Robert McNeely, and pianist Chris White.
I might add there, Holly Holmes is also going to be singing with us.
Ah, good. Day. So maybe we'll get them to modify the website. The talk's going to be called Now It Can Be Told, Irving Berlin's Songs for Stage and Screen. And hopefully before too long, we'll get a chance to see Jeff McGee's new book on Irving Berlin, once it gets done, and publisher probably breathing down your neck, I imagine, or it will be eventually,
right?
The way those things go. So why don't you introduce this last song?
Okay.
You brought a couple of quick samples of.
Right. Let's do a pair, and this is kind of leaping ahead, but I want to end here with the point, I guess, that the songbook is endlessly flexible and expandable, and in recent years... Well, let's put it this way. Jazz musicians have always played pop songs, and so it shouldn't be any surprise that they're playing songs of the rock era, not just the so-called Great American Songbook. But I think as they play these songs, they too enter the songbook. The key difference is that in case of rock songs, the sort of the source material is a recording, not a piece of sheet music. So you've got musicians playing rock era songs that are known to a big public through the performer who is often the composer, and that's the case with this one. Let's just hear about a minute of.
And before we launch into it, I actually have to do something that I'm required to do. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a tornado watch for portions of central Illinois effective until 7 o'clock tonight. And in our immediate severe weather coverage area, this tornado watch includes these counties in Illinois: DeWitt, Livingston, Logan, Macon, McLean, Piatt, and Sangamon. That tornado watch, in effect, until 7 o'clock this evening.
Okay. Yeah, let's hear maybe 30 seconds to a minute of Don Henley's tune, New York Minute. And then we'll segue into Herbie Hancock's reinterpretation of the song on a album he came out with about a decade ago called The New Standard, which I think is kind of a telling title. And it's a whole album devoted to pop songs by the likes of Don Henley, Simon and Garfunkel, I'm blanking out on the others, Kurt Cobain, of all people.
Yeah, and there's tons of new
ones. So... that's the whole theme, is that the standard, the universe of standards, is expanding.
And we will say thanks to Jeffrey McGee, our guest.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
On Live and Local. We'll have you back.
Lying in the darkness, hear the sirens wail. Somebody going to emergency. Somebody's gone to jail. You find somebody to love in this world, you better hang on tooth and nail. The wolf is always at the door.